Yeah, Larry, let's get started with the conflict in the Middle East. Is Netanyahu achieving its objectives in the Middle East, in your opinion?
It all depends on what you label as his objectives. On the one hand, you could say that his objective is, as he stated it so often, to defeat entirely Hamas and to essentially leave a Gaza that is manageable, governable, whatever. Is he accomplishing that? Absolutely not. I saw the figures this morning from two different sources, roughly jiving. Hamas has retrofitted, if you will, raised new battalions, new fighters. Its total capacity for waging a conflict like it's done to this point is about the same as it was when we started, about eight battalions. That's a significant number of guerrillas. And obviously they've been attrited, surely, but they've grown it back. So in terms of his stated objective, no. But let's look at his real objectives, of which the trip to the United States and the appearance before the United States Congress, as egregious and reprehensible as that was for America, was an indicator. Because when he talked to Josh Hawley and he talked to Tom Cotton and he talked to Lindsey Graham and others like them, he got what he wanted, and plus he's back in Israel with a small bump up in the polls, which is what he wanted also. What he told them he wanted, and this is only partially what he really wants, I think, he wanted to take on Hezbollah and defeat them. And ultimately, if Iran responded in any way that was significantly injurious to Israel's security, he would respond to Iran with U.S. backing. That's pretty much what he wanted, and that's what he went away with, which is why he was fairly happy with the trip, a bump in the polls, an agreement that he could do what he wanted. So then he went, and he started executing what he thought would be the prompters. He wasn't going to wait for Iran, and he wasn't going to wait for Hezbollah, which started with his taking advantage of a situation in the Golan Heights, where some Druze that we now know, none of whom were Israeli citizens, they were all Syrians. They were all Syrian citizens. They all were loyal to Bashar al-Assad. They all hate Israel. They don't like the occupation. And if anything, they would join the fight against Israel. So why in the world would Hezbollah shoot them? Well, Hezbollah didn't shoot them. But Netanyahu and Smotrich in particular jumped on it immediately and started saying that Hezbollah had done it to make this the casus belli for Israel retaliating, as they subsequently did, and killing people actually in Beirut, very high-level people in Beirut, and causing Hezbollah and Nasrallah to have to react and thus bring the United States in, because Lloyd Austin said if Israel is attacked, we'll back them up. And that's what he's trying to provoke. He's trying to provoke Hezbollah to attack him in a visible way that really does some damage in Israel, but not too much. And then he's going to attack them. How does he get to Iran? He gets to Iran by successfully bringing the United States in and getting admired in taking care of Hezbollah for him. And go back to 1982 and 83, and you'll see how difficult that is. And it's much different now. They're much better. Hezbollah is much better than the guerrillas that we were fighting in 1982 and 83. And that'll bring on the big one. Now, he sort of doubled down his bets when he took out the leader, absolutely illogically, took out the leader of the political side of Hamas, who was doing most of the negotiations. And I listened to Alistair Crook this morning, very vivid description of a friend of his being in the floor below Haniya and the explosion that took place and what happened to him. And the pondering on the part of everyone around as to what in the world would they do this for, because this is the man that was going to bring a ceasefire. This is the man that ultimately would be the person they negotiated with. Well, sorry, you missed it, Iranian. The reason he did it is his other purpose is to start a war with you and have the United States on his side. And he does that when, again, go back to Lloyd Austin's remarks, we will be with Israel if they are attacked, Iran attacks Israel, which now I think even the new president in Iran, and certainly the Ayatollah and the IRGC and others in the decision-making process in Iran, believe that they have to really do something truly damaging to Israel. So Netanyahu's strategy is working. He's just not telling anybody about it. He's broadcasting it. Any fool can see it. And, you know, I'm not insinuating that people who don't see it aren't fools. I'm just saying that any person who has watched Netanyahu up to this point knows that he has gone over to the dark side, and he is absolutely committed to bringing the United States into a much wider regional war, which will leave Israel able to do what it wants to do, which is to spread mercilessly throughout the region, to include colonizing as quickly as possible Gaza once the dust settles. That's Netanyahu's plan. And he doesn't, by the way, he doesn't ever want to leave this. Only the grave will take him away from this. He wants to stay in power, and he wants the bulk of the Israeli people to be behind him. And I fear to God that they will be as he does this and as he brings us into it. What does that mean for other powers in the region, though? And what does that mean for other big powers in the world? That's the huge question, which no one from Blinken to Biden to Harris to Austin, none of them seem to be thinking about, because they are not going to rest content with Bibi doing this. I'm not even sure Turkey's going to rest content with Bibi's doing it. But that's his strategy.
Larry, if you put yourself in the shoes of Iranians right now, the question is how they can deal with Netanyahu and his administration. The way that they're like just bombing each and everybody right now in the Middle East. And at the same time, they're having these tensions with Iranians. They're attacking Gazans. They're killing people, innocent people in Gaza. And it's unbelievable what they're doing right now and how they can deal with Netanyahu, because they're coming to their countries and assassinating people who are so important for the future of the conflict in Gaza.
There's the other side of the coin that I didn't describe to you, that I had described to me very vividly this morning. And that is that the unrest in the IDF right now, which is significant, they are sick and tired of killing for killing's sake. They do not see any strategy. They do not see any end to the killing until there's no Palestinians left to kill. They don't see what they're doing. The reservists in particular are not happy about what they see as a potential war on the other front with Hezbollah and being transferred to that front and having to fight there as well. They know through experience or through the grapevine what happened to them in 2006 and 2007 when they took on Hezbollah. So they don't want that. At the same time, you've got a massive number of the 800,000 plus settlers who are ready to go to war against the IDF, who are already threatening to do it in key areas where the IDF is making it a little bit hard to continue with the strategy. Not breaking out in large areas right now, but in isolated places, it's happening already. So you have this potential for a civil war inside Israel between the 800,000 plus settlers and those in the IDF who are very discontented with what's going on and don't see any end game, don't see any strategy whatsoever. Netanyahu is riding a tiger or two right now. He dare not dismount. He dare not stay on. And so he's in the proverbial place of a dictator riding a tiger. It's an extremely dangerous thing. There is a distinct possibility that my former prediction that Israel as a state won't exist in a few years will come to pass a lot quicker. And it'll be by military means that Israel is destroyed, and by internecine warfare in its own ranks, rather than by some external militias from Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, or whatever. They may be winding up destroying themselves. Now, into this whole mix, we have to immediately think of Iran's capacity to go immediately to a nuclear weapon and of Israel's already possessing nuclear weapons. And we have to think about what that means in terms of Iran's considerations with regard to, for example, right now, tactical consideration, but could be immensely strategic in regards to the latest killing of Haniyeh. I don't think the Ayatollah, the IRGC, even the new president, I don't think they're going to be able to get away with a less than what the ruling structure will approve as an adequate response. Now, if I were they, and I had the talent and the skill to do it, and that's a huge question with Iran. I'm not sure they do have the talent and skill to do it because they haven't bred it. They haven't wanted to breed it. And they have done some things overseas before, and they've done some things extraterritorially, if you will, that indicate to me that there may be some expertise for this sort of thing, but it's not their general practice. But what I would do is I would go back at Israel tit for tat. This would be an enormous response in terms of Israel's having killed Haniyeh, but it would not be, I don't think, a casus belli. And by that, I simply mean go in there and kill someone. Go in there and kill Smotrich, kill Ben-Gvir. I know they're very highly guarded. I know Netanyahu comes with battalions around him, but they do fly around and they do things that would allow them to be in vulnerable places at certain times. So I'm not suggesting that this tit-for-tat killing should take place, but I am suggesting that Iran needs to discover a way to appease its own audience, so to speak, and to look as if it has stood up to Israel at the same time that it does not start a war, which neither it nor Washington wants between the two. That's what did the April 1st, April 14th, April 20th deal, if you will. The diplomacy that was conducted behind the scenes made sure that Iran got credit for a formidable response to the killing of its diplomats in Damascus, but it didn't start a war. It didn't do such things as Lloyd Austin would say, you know, we have to come to Israel's defense now. So it did not start a war, which it didn't want to do, nor did Washington. Now we're at that same impasse again, but Iran has sort of got its hands tied. It does have to do something, and I'm sure it's contemplating what it's going to do right now. This is going to complicate the situation for everyone, but in terms of Netanyahu's secret strategy, if you will, it's just what he wants. He hopes that Iran responds in a way that is clear, dramatic, maybe kills a lot of Israelis, maybe does a lot of damage to Israel, and that way he's got the United States. And if that fails, Hezbollah will do it for him. So Netanyahu feels probably right now like he's sitting on the top of the world. He just got rebuked badly in the Golan. I mean, him and Smotrich both, they heckled him. They held signs up, kind of like Medea Benjamin in this country. They didn't want Netanyahu or Smotrich or anyone from the Israeli leadership complex on the ground in the Golan, because they knew damn well Hezbollah didn't shoot those missiles. Now, whether it was an accident or not, or it was a false flag operation by Netanyahu, who knows? Whatever, they do know, they believe that Hezbollah had nothing to do with it. And I think they're probably right. So this is not going that smoothly for Netanyahu, but it doesn't have to go that smoothly. All he needs is for Nasrallah to make a decision to go big time from that side of Israel, and for Iran to make a decision to, in parallel with or leading or just behind, make a decision to do something formidable. And he's got his war. He's got his regional war, and he's got the United States buried in it.
Larry, if Iran doesn't get involved militarily with Israel and just Hezbollah getting involved and just Iran helping Hezbollah, do you think that that would bring the United States in as well?
That's an option, but it doesn't give the Iranian people, if that's consequential, and I think to a certain extent it is, it doesn't give them the feeling that Iran did the strike. It doesn't give them the feeling that we were embarrassed. We were sorely embarrassed. I mean, what did they do? They fired a whole bunch of people. I think they probably put them in jail for life that failed with the security detail, or even might have been complicit with the killing. I don't know. Different stories are coming out of Iran right now. So if they just use Hezbollah for the response, not only would they caused Lebanon to be probably destroyed. It's already a basket case. But they also would probably put Hezbollah on their back heel, even though they would give Israel a real fight, a significant fight, much more so than Hamas is. And then Hamas would be given not only the refreshing that it needs in terms of, which it's got now, in terms of reinforcements and new fighters and new battalions, it would also give them the boost in morale by knowing that Israel is now enmeshed on its other flank, and they are, so to speak, hitting them in the rear, because there are just not enough troops to cover all of this if you look at it through time. Israel is going to be attrited to the point where there are going to be enemies left, and there are going to be no forces, formidable forces in Israel to take them on. And I told you about this potential civil war between the settlers and those in the IDF who don't agree with what's happening right now in Gaza. They don't agree with what's happening in the West Bank to a large extent either. So this is a festering thing that's been there for a long time. It's manifested itself in things like breaking the silence and the movement that breaks away from the IDF and refuses to serve anymore, or leaves, and leaves Israel even. That's another thing. You've got, essentially, you've got non-combatant evacuation operations either contemplated or taking place across the region. You certainly got them in Lebanon. You've probably got them in Israel right now in terms of not being able to get a flight out, in terms of getting a flight out if you possibly can. There are people leaving the region, which is a precursor to a wider war. There probably is no more graphic and vivid an indicator of a coming conflict than when states feel so apparently seized of that potential that they tell their citizens, officially or unofficially, to get out. And that's what's happening now. Israelis are leaving because they don't want to die in this state that's supposed to bring security to Jews. They don't want to die, and they might die, so they're leaving. This is really, I think, in many respects, the end of Israel as a Jewish state.
It seems that the Netanyahu administration is so happy with the current situation. They brought the United States into the conflict in the Middle East right now. Iran is prepared to attacking them. And on the other hand, they just draw the tensions to the conflict between Iran and Israel and the United States right now. Nobody seems to care what's going on right now in Gaza. It's much more important what's going on there. And they're killing. Their main objective to kill and each and everybody in Gaza is just...
That's part of his strategy.
Seems to pay attention.
That's part of his strategy too, is to get the attention off Gaza and get it on a wider war, and get it on a wider war that Israel seems to be imperiled in. Israel is not vividly and in your face imperiled in Gaza. It's killing men, women, and children. Now, Hamas is bringing some pain, that's to be sure, and will bring more pain, and they are certainly not defeated. But he wants the attention off that, because that is a genocide. That is a genocide. So he wants something else that looks more like a war. And he wants Israel to be hard pressed by that war to bring in the United States and to muddy the waters, if you will, so that people will forget about what he did in Gaza and just be worried about the survival of Israel. And that'll be the United States cue to take over and to fight right alongside Israel and to do beyond what Israel can do with its assets. Now, here's the kicker there. I've said this all along. If the United States, I back up a little bit. When I was at the Pacific Command in the early 80s, after the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan, and we were fearful, very fearful, that the Soviets were coming on down to Chabahar and Bandar Abbas and the southern tip of the Persian Gulf. And all. Go back to all the empires in history who've coveted the Persian Gulf and those routes. Well, the Russians were one of those empires. And so the fear came back, vividly came back in the War Planning Division of the Pacific Command. What would we do? Because we were the force provider. Central Command didn't even hardly exist then. It was just a little spot on the map. We were the force provider of Pacific Command, so we were doing the war planning. I had to do some of the war planning fighting in Iran. I know how tough it would be to fight in those mountains. I know how tough it would be to fight, period, in Iran. I know how tough it would be to fight against 80 million people, each one of whom would become a guerrilla immediately. We aren't going to win. If we go to war against Iran, the only way to assure that Bibi's objectives are met, the most paramount of which is elimination of the nuclear program and its potential for resurgence, we have to go on the ground. You cannot do that with bombs. You cannot do that with anything but soldiers rooting out the nuclear facilities and getting rid of them. That's the only way you can do it. We do that, we're going to get our rear ends handed to us. We do not have the forces. We'll have to call for conscription, a draft. We'll have to build up the forces in order to do it. We'll have to fully, or at least three quarters, partial mobilization, we call it. I think we'll have to fully mobilize. When we do that, half the youth of America are going to head for Canada and Mexico, if not more. Not only that, three quarters of the youth of America between the ages of 18 and 24 are not fit for military service. This is a recipe for the empire coming down, and coming down not on a gradual glide slope, but coming down catastrophically. We, the United States of America, do not want to go to war with Iran on the ground, period. What would we do if we realized that at the last minute and had to do something nonetheless that we felt was existential with regard to Israel? Think about that for a minute. Think about the other weapons we have in our arsenal. Think about the other weapons that Bibi has in his arsenal.
Larry, how does this unconditional support of the United States for Israel in the Middle East would convince each and every country in the Middle East to go after nuclear bombs?
You have an incredible potential for a nuclear arms race in the region, and no stopping it. I mean, everybody that could possibly get involved takes me back to the AQ Khan network again, when the father of the Pakistani bomb was trying to get 6-7 countries and had 5 or 6 of them interested, including Libya, including Argentina, including Brazil, interested at one time or another in listening to the deal in any event. We'd be back to that for the Levant in big time. I mean, you'd be looking at countries who would make the decision. The biggest element we found in deciding not to go for a nuclear weapon, even if you had a peaceful nuclear program, like many of these countries do, the biggest detriment or negative part of the decision was the cost. It's enormously expensive to build either a plutonium-based or uranium-based weapons facility or weapons capacity, let alone build them both, which is, you know, what the superpowers did in order to ensure both sides, plutonium and uranium, was viable. Very expensive. And so you had people making decisions. These aren't necessarily rich countries, not in the scope of Russia or the United States or China. So they made wise decisions, I think. And much of the decision was based on economics. We can't afford that. You know, we might want a bomb, but we can't afford that. So the prestige of having a nuclear weapon didn't outweigh the cost of building that weapon and maintaining the nuclear complex. That's what South Korea is confronting. They, you know, they were talking all about having a bomb and all the system. Now they've been briefed real thoroughly on how much it costs. And you need a testing facility. And you need a place to store the nuclear waste. And that's no easy task. Look at the United States, the political problems we had with that. And we still haven't solved it. We still have not solved it. It's just sitting there waiting to do something to somebody someday. So these problems are huge. If we got this started in the Middle East, there would be states, I think, that have the money to do it. And Saudi Arabia comes to mind immediately. And the empty desert to at least solve the other problems temporarily, which is essentially what we did and what the Russians did. Temporarily. Look at the destruction that we've uncovered now in the old Soviet Union, Russia today, because they didn't do it very wisely. Well, you can say we did it a little bit more wisely, but we still got the same problems with nuclear waste. Hanford up in Washington State, for us, for example, is a ticking time bomb. I've been told by nuclear physicists who've worked up there, I've been told that it would make Chernobyl look like child's play when Hanford goes. You have fields of 55-gallon drums, just fields of them, with nuclear waste inside of them leaking. You don't want to take these problems on. But your point about there would be countries that would take them on if we get into this situation with Iran and the United States and Israel and Turkey maybe and Russia and China, then we're off to the races and people are wanting a weapon simply to protect themselves. And that's a sad development to have that much violation, if you will, of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty instantly, overnight, and backed by huge amounts of money. In the case of the Saudis, backed by almost infinite wealth.
Yeah, last time we talked, you remember you said you were so positive about what China is doing in terms of bringing these Palestinian groups together. And maybe it seems that one of the main objectives of this assassination of Ismail Haniyeh was just to sabotage that agreement.
Yes, that was not a good development, not a positive development for Netanyahu, because it was a thorn in his strategy. It might have even worked. And that leaves Netanyahu in jail and unelected.
Yeah. Larry, do we know what the government in Qatar is thinking of the current situation of the Middle East, about what's going on with Israel and the United States in Qatar? And what are they talking about? How do they communicate with the United States, in your opinion, right now?
I'd love to talk to Bill Burns and ask him his assessment of their views. They are probably extremely worried that all the careful diplomacy they have exercised over the last 30 years, that all the delicate deals that they've done with everything from the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, to the Turks, to the Saudis, when they had their imbroglio with the Saudis and the Turks came in and sort of said, hey, we'll have your back while you work this out. And of course, they did work it out because Saudi Arabia did not want to have that kind of contention with Turkey. The Qataris and the Omanis are always in there offering their good offices and their money and their meeting facilities, their conference rooms and everything else. So all the other disputants can have a place to meet that's, well, they actually did the Taliban and the negotiations that Khalilzad for us screwed up so badly that made a mess of us when we left Afghanistan. Another neoconservative who left his mark on crucial theater of war. I don't know what they're thinking now, except, man, it's all going to pot. It's all going to hell in a handbag. I don't know that my money and my good offices and my duplicity, because they are duplicitous sons of guns, working at the same time with Netanyahu to help Hamas run Gaza, at the same time probably somewhat knowledgeable about Hamas's feelings about, you know, a third intifada, a second, whatever you might want to term it. It's hard to know what they're thinking. I'm sure they're worried. I'm sure they're deeply concerned, and they're particularly concerned about. This is what we found when I was in the State Department and when I was in the military, too. The Saudis always worry about, the Kuwaitis always worry about, the Bahrainis even worry about, although they're not quite as worrisome because they know they're sitting on a powder keg 24/7. We don't want the United States in the region in any significant way unless it is absolutely, totally existential if they're not. This is what deliberations that went on for the first Gulf War, for example, when Cheney, as Secretary of Defense, had to go to Riyadh and talk them into Saddam might come on into Saudi Arabia and get your oil assets. And that was all the Saudis needed to hear. And then the invitation for us to put major forces on the ground in the Middle East for the first time ever for the United States, that became an easier thing for them to swallow. But they're back where they were before. Now, they don't want too much. They want enough. They don't want too much. So us coming back in a major way and taking on Iran might seem like Mohammed bin Salman or any of the other leaders on the other side of the Gulf, as it were, would be welcoming of that. No, I don't think so. Not necessarily, because they know that when we come in, it's ponderous, it's heavy, and it stinks for a long time afterwards. The first Gulf War was an exception. First Gulf War was an exception because H.W. Bush and Colin Powell and Dick Cheney at that time all understood, we go in, we get out, and we do not unseat Saddam Hussein. Well, George Bush screwed that up, completely screwed that up, and demonstrated what we meant by residual American power in the region on the ground is bad. Bad for everybody. Bad for the native populations and bad for the United States. And we've proven that in spades. And now we're talking about going back. And Bibi's inviting us. So you talk about a deeper and more tragic disaster. That's what we're inviting.
And how Washington, in your opinion, politically, how Washington is weak in terms of having some sort of communication, lines of communication between Washington and Iran. Right now, we've seen that Jordanians were trying to just sending message to Iran and Grant there. We know that Iranians don't care about Jordanians. And why Washington is in a such a weak position right now in the Middle East in terms politically?
First of all, we've got an election coming up and nobody's paying any attention except spasmodically. And we've got incompetence in Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken. I'm beginning to think we've got an incompetent at the Defense Department in terms of Secretary Austin. So that's pretty sweeping what I just said. The elections are taking everybody's attention. There's more attention right now, Nima, right here, right now, this minute, there's more attention as to who Harris is going to select as a running mate than there is to Gaza or Ukraine. It's disgusting. People are dying, and they're dying because of U.S. errors and U.S. mistakes and the lack of U.S. diplomacy and the utter lack of any courage on the part of the American leadership. And we're talking about who she's going to pick for her vice presidential candidate. And we're lambasting Donald Trump on one side and praising Harris on the other side and lambasting Harris on the other side. You know, it's crazy. But it's the political heyday, the height of the political season in America. No one cares about anything else. It doesn't matter that women and children are dying in Gaza. I saw one guy this morning, he's talking about how, where's the hunger? Where's the hunger? I don't see anybody dying of hunger. Well, get your ass over there, dude. Get your ass over there. Hire out to UNRWA. Hire out to some NGO that's in the region. Go over there and put your boots on the ground and see if you can find some starving people. I guarantee you can, you know, if you can find them under the rubble. But that's what we have in this country today. That's what we have. There's no meaningful discussion about what's going on. I dare say most Americans just say, oh, well, get it over with. Get it over with, and we'll have the elections, and we'll see what happens then. We have no leadership, Nima, and we have no diplomacy. Bill Burns is carrying the entire weight of American diplomacy on his shoulders right now. I feel like I can say that with certainty. And he's doing it in Oman. He's doing it in Qatar. He's doing it all throughout the region. And he's probably almost brain dead now from the tension and the pressure that's on him to carry out meaningful diplomacy, especially with regard to keeping Iran from doing what Bibi wants him to do, which is to attack Israel in such a flagrant, blatant way that he can claim casus belli. We're going to war with Iran. Oh, and you're going to be with me, right? And Washington, stupid, lackey slave of Israel that it is, will say, well, yeah, I guess we are.
In your opinion, right now, Netanyahu and his administration are feeling that they're winning the conflict politically. That's why because there's two assassinations. And one, the political and the military leaders of Hamas have been assassinated. Do you think, how do they feel about it? They think that they just weakened Hamas, or what's going on in their mind, in your opinion?
I think that's the image they're trying to convey, they're first of all conveying the image that Israel can hit anybody anywhere, anytime, night or day. The second is just what you said, that we're winning. I'm sorry, you're not. We had this discussion at the highest levels of the United States government. When you take out bin Laden, will it really change anything? When you take out his deputy, will it really change anything? When you take out any leader of any terrorist organization that has a purpose and a capacity to implement that purpose, does it really change anything? No. That was the conclusion of everyone around the table. So why were we doing it, was the question that was pregnant in the room. And the answer came from a old 45, 50 year old woman sitting in the corner who was from the, as I recall, we didn't have the DNI at that time. I think she was from the group that we used to have under the director of Central Intelligence, who was the predecessor to the DNI, called for the National Intelligence Council. And she said, because it's all we can do. You know, that was the truth. Lying on the table, naked. It's all we can do. Does it stop anything? Probably not. Does it change anything? No. In fact, we did a couple of case studies of where we eliminated a particular leader of a particular group. One was a drone strike, Predator drone strike, and one was an actual, let's put it this way, special operating forces. And the person who came in and took that person's place once that person was dead actually turned out to be more competent and more deadly and more potent than the guy we'd killed. Then we started that conversation over again. You know, what are we doing? How is this impacting their ability and their capacity to attack assets that we value? It's not. And that's the problem with saying you're fighting terrorism. You cannot fight a methodology. You can fight an idea with another idea, a better idea, hopefully, and you might have a chance of winning. But you cannot wage war against a methodology. And that's what we did for years. And we failed. We failed in Afghanistan. We failed in Iraq. We failed across the world in terms of the global war on terror. Ali Soufan right now will tell you that Al-Qaeda is stronger than it ever was, certainly stronger than before, and with greater capacity than before 9/11. Especially Al-Qaeda in Yemen. They've just had, like Afghanistan before, they've had so much turmoil in Yemen that they've been unscathed. They've been able to train, they've been able to educate, they've been able to recruit, they've been able to increase their ranks, make their ranks more proficient, make their ranks more deadly. They get plenty of support from you-know-who and others. What the heck? Al-Qaeda in Yemen is probably going to attack somebody very shortly. And I'll give you three guesses as to whom, and the first two don't count.
Larry, how do you find the situation between the United States and Israel? Do you think that they're saying to Israel that this time would be the last time that they're going to be there to support them, or they're going to be there anyway? Doesn't matter how much Netanyahu and his administration is going to escalate the conflict.
Ask me that again. I'm not sure exactly what you're...
My question is, what would be the limit for the United States to support Israel with these escalations that are happening?
Oh, it's unlimited. With this administration, and I suspect, I hate to say this, Lord, I hate to say this, I suspect with almost any administration I could contemplate, it's unlimited. All that's required, Austin stated it categorically, all that's required is that Netanyahu make it look like Israel was attacked. I won't even say what Austin said. If Israel is attacked, we will come to their defense, because Netanyahu is behind it. Netanyahu will make sure Israel is attacked. So you're really coming because Bibi called you. But that's our policy. We will come to Israel's defense. And if you've watched any of these tapes with Medea Benjamin following congressmen around on the Hill, you know that what Mark Twain, I wrote it down the other day, there is no distinctly American criminal class, Mark Twain said, save the Congress. He was right. It is the distinctly American criminal class, the United States Congress. And that criminal class will go with Israel into hell.
There, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, do you think, as we just talking about Middle East, is the case of Ukraine passing away?
Well, I think the administration would like for that to happen. They don't like either one in the publicity they're getting for them, but they would love to have one at least wipe the other out, whichever way it worked. I don't think it's going to happen. Video this morning, I don't know if it was legitimate video or not, but I'm looking at it. I think it was on YouTube, of the first F-16 flying over Odessa. And I'm thinking, well, I wonder who's flying that F-16. And I'm also thinking about the process that we went through in this country to get the F-16. It's an elaborate process. It wasn't built the same way most aircraft are built. It was built by a rebellious group in the Air Force who said, we don't want one of these planes built by Lockheed. You know, we want a plane that we've designed. Anyway, it is a superb fighter, but it's been around a long time now. It's still a superb fighter. It's still a superb fighter bomber. And it has no business being in Ukraine. No business whatsoever being in Ukraine. The Russians will shoot it out of the sky. There's no question in my mind, unless you've got swarms of them and they're adequately equipped and the pilots are good. The F-16, when it came online, was so good that pilots of the old school, you know, the Top Gun types, they didn't trust it. They wanted to fly it. They didn't trust the computer system in it, very sophisticated. So they wanted to fly it. Well, a couple of them wound up killing themselves, because they could not possibly compete with that aircraft's internal components and the way it flew itself, especially at high G pulls and really tight turns and so forth. So they finally figured out, let the plane fly itself. Don't try to interfere with the plane. It's a fabulous airplane, but the technology is older now. The pylon stores, the weapons and such are not. They're, you know, mostly precision, if not all precision, and it can carry nuclear weapons. But you can't put an F-16 in the sky with 20 Soviet or Russian planes and expect the F-16 to survive. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a few F-16s over the skies of Ukraine that they would be insane if they put up into that air supremacy, really, that the Russians have, and you're going to lose them. So what have we created other than a symbol, as I saw in the video this morning, F-16 flies over Odessa. Well, okay, and then what? And the bottom line here, Nima, is that Russians and Ukrainians are dying, and they are dying for no purpose. Not anymore. Not Russians aren't dying for any purpose either, because they've accomplished what they needed to accomplish, which is to give them enough breathing room to where the United States cannot put missiles that target Moscow in the ranges that they feel are existential. That's the whole ballgame here. And when Lindsey Graham stands up and says that Vladimir Putin is another Hitler and he's going to come take on the whole, Lindsey Graham is a lying sack of shit. He's been a lying sack of shit for about 20 years. But people listen to him, and people listen to Josh Hawley, and they listen to Tom Cotton, they listen to other of these idiots who are really on the defense complex tit, making tons of money off of it. That's why they say these things. They're really not that stupid. They're just venal and criminal. As Mark Twain said, the criminal class in the United States is the Congress. So this is really pitiful that we're continuing to do this in Ukraine. And here's the real clincher. As long as the elections are pending, there's probably going to be no meaningful diplomacy. And even what Zelensky's trying to do, Blinken or Sullivan or Austin or somebody will run to Kyiv in order to stop him, in order to tell him, no, you can't be doing that. You can't be doing that. I hope he tells them to go to hell. I frankly hope he tells them to go to hell. and he'll be foreclosing his money and other things that come from us. You know, and if he makes any public announcement about it, the Congress will cut him off completely. They want to anyway, because they realize what fiscal problems they have now. They're beginning to realize it. You see the stock market today? I hope I'm wrong, but this could be some signaling going on. It's not just about the jobs report or just about the Biden administration and the kind of cacophony that's coming out of it, or some of the other things that they're saying the downturn is about. You know, it's a feeling amongst the American people. It's a beginning of the development of a lack of confidence in the financial situation, which they sense. They don't necessarily intellectually appreciate it, but they sense is not right. And they sense there's no leadership of high caliber to write it. And I'm not sure even the best leadership in the world could write it now, because we let the debt get so gargantuan. But there are people who are going to start speaking out, I think, once the election has occurred. I think they're already putting tremendous pressure on Harris right now, they being a certain wing of the Democratic Party, to guarantee them before she makes a VP selection and before she gets the full backing and goes into the election with all the money and everything from the Democratic National Committee behind her, before all that happens, she gives them some kind of guarantees she's not going to be Biden. And the big issue there is Gaza. If she turns out to be just another Biden, another, you know, whatever Israel wants, Israel gets, she's going to lose half the people she got getting elected before she even gets to 60 days or 100 days in office. So I hope that's going to have some impact, too. And I've heard from Democrats that this is happening. So I'm going to be anxious to see how she squares that in the debates and in her speaking in general, if she starts to address some of that, to back away from Biden, to ease away from Biden, or if she has to wait until the ballots are cast and she's elected, and then how fast she does it. But she's going to have to do something. We can't continue the way we are. We simply can't.
Larry, just to wrap up this session, in your opinion, Russians are talking about if the United States continue providing Ukraine with weapons and with aid, they're going to help these groups in the Middle East to fight back. And Ari, how dangerous is this for this conflict in the Middle East?
I think if you bring Russia in, you bring China in. I don't think Xi Jinping and Putin were necessarily blood brothers in the gatherings that they've had, but I do think they saw eye to eye on the danger of the empire and the continuing danger of the empire, both from an economic and financial point of view. That's why they are very carefully working on replacing SWIFT, replacing the whole Bretton Woods complex, replacing the WTO, or changing the WTO to where the United States doesn't have so much colossal weight and causes so many things to go astray. It gets its point of view across, but no one else can get their point of view across. Same with the IMF. They're doing all this, and they're doing it slowly and carefully behind the scenes. I think your president is privy to some of that, and I think he's going along with it, and I applaud him for it. Not because I'm trying to be a traitor to my country, but because I realize the world needs a new system. It desperately needs a new system, and one that is not dominated by the United States of America, which has become unbearable, absolutely unbearable. You see that they finally read an article in the mainstream media saying we have sanctions on one third of the world. No schnock. Where did you come from? We've had those sanctions for some time. One third of the world is sanctioned by the United States of America, individually or state-wise, or in some cases, both, through their state and individually. So we got to get out of this, and we got to get out of it without too much turmoil or too much killing and murdering and slaughter and warring. I don't know that we're going to do that, because we seem to be bereft of leadership to do the kind of diplomacy necessary to shut down Ukraine and to shut down Gaza. Instead, we seem to want to exacerbate them. And as long as we do that, then we're going to invite the Russians and the Chinese and others, the Turks, for example, into helping the other side. That's just the way of the world.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Truly. Sure. You know, if I were Putin, you know, if I were king today of Moscow in Russia, I would start doing things even in our own hemisphere, just like you and I have discussed before, that he's just done sort of to put, you know, fingers in the U.S.'s eyes, submarine and a frigate to Cuba. And I'd start doing some more serious things. And if I were the Chinese, I'd start patrolling for freedom of navigation in the Gulf of Mexico on a routine basis. And I would make sure I sailed right next to the 12 nautical mile territorial limit, like the Soviets used to do. I mean, I used to look out my window from the Pacific Command in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I could look all the way out across Pearl and into the Pacific Ocean. And at that time, it was a 3-mile territorial limit. We didn't have the law of the sea treaty change to 12 miles. It was 3 miles. At 3 miles and 100 meters, I could see the Soviet AGIs turning their lasers on me to listen to me. You know, that's what the Chinese ought to do to us.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry.
Truly.
Great pleasure. See you soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.